All right, good morning. It is 10 a.m. I will call us to order for our regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting. We have a rather lengthy agenda today, so we'll move through it as expeditiously as possible, and we'll start, as we always do, by honoring America with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, thank you and good morning. First item on our agenda is public comment number one. This is an opportunity for members of the public to address topics on today's agenda. Anybody wishing to do so? And seeing no one moving the microphone, we'll move on to agency reports. And we have our friends from Storytime here today. Jane, how are you?
Good.
Hey.
Thanks for coming over.
Yeah. Well, on behalf of Storytime, I'd like to say thank you for the county's continual support to Storytime. Storytime has been serving families in Collins, Maxwell, and surrounding areas since 1991. Our enrollment average is about the same every year, though last year it decreased about 11 kids.
Wow.
Yeah. We had quite a few foster kids, and then we had one family that moved, which that was four kids right there. But we're on a steady increase again, so that's a good thing. And right now I employ eight teachers. And we provide infant care, full-time care, preschool, before and after school care, and summer care for the school-agers.
Very good. So what challenges, if any, are you facing right now?
Right now we faced a little bit with the school because they have the preschool program over there, and it's free.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so we faced a little bit of that. But otherwise, a lot of our kids, they're full-time. And so the parents, since we provide preschool, they just keep them there instead of taking them over to Collins. Mm-hmm. And we provide the same service. It's just now the school provides the service that we do also.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
But you said you were still growing. How is your staff retention?
I'm sorry, what?
Staff retention.
They're great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So of your eight, how long have they been with you?
I've been there for 20 years, and then my assistant director's 10, and the rest of the teachers, 4 years or longer.
That's good.
Yeah, so I don't have a big staff turnover, which mm-hmm. I think that's important. Right. That way the kids know who they're going to see every day.
Right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay.
Well, I think it's an important service you provide, and we should appreciate you being part of it.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely. Okay. Thanks for coming over today.
Mm-hmm.
Next item on the agenda is presentation for America's Renewable Fuel, an RFS standard. Roxanne Doss. Roxanne, how are you? Good,
mm-hmm.
Thank you. Roxanne and I had coffee probably, my time runs together, a couple months?
About a month.
Okay.
Maybe month and a half.
So. Okay.
Thank you very much.
And do you want me to
Thank
speak
you.
Over here?
Yes, please. And start by introducing yourself and your title.
Okay. Well, I am Roxanne Doss. I am the Regional Field Director for North Central Iowa with America's Renewable Future. So my region covers 19 counties from Ames all the way up to the Minnesota border. So I have a pretty large region. And America's Renewable Future is a coalition of businesses, individuals, and organizations working to protect the renewable fuel standard here in Iowa. And for people who don't know, the RFS is basically the federal mandate that says we blend renewable fuels from ethanol to soy biodiesel to the used cooking grease that's converted into our gas for our cars and motor vehicles. And we're working to protect it because the oil industry has been trying to repeal the RFS, which is set to run until 2022, mostly because it cuts into their profit margins. But the RFS is extremely important to Iowa because we have so much corn and soybeans that goes into the biofuels industry. It creates, the ethanol industry alone creates about 73,000 jobs from not just the farmers to the biofuels plant workers, but the truckers to Fisher and Marshalltown that creates the valves for the factories. And that's about $5 billion in wages to Iowans. And biofuels just burn cleaner than regular gasoline. Ethanol itself burns about 33% cleaner than gasoline alone. And then there's cellulosic ethanol, which is made from the corn stalks, which burns 100% cleaner. And there's also research going into algae ethanol and other forms of biofuels that we can use in our gasoline. And so it's important for so many reasons, and especially in Iowa. And so what our organization is doing is we are meeting, our senior staff is meeting one-on-one with the presidential candidates, educating them about the RFS, having them go out and talk to people who the biofuels industry affects here in Iowa, and hopefully getting their support of renewable fuels here in Iowa. So far, all the Democrats are 100% supportive. Martin O'Malley has come out in support of it. Hillary Clinton did an op-ed that says she supports that 100%. Bernie Sanders, we haven't gotten an official statement from him, but he is very supportive of renewable fuels. On the Republican side, Rick Santorum, Jeb Bush, Mike Huckabee are all supportive of the RFS. About the others talk about a phase out, a phasing it out before 2022. And the only two very staunch opponents of the RFS are Rick Perry and Ted Cruz. But that's not very surprising. They're from Texas. They're oil people. But we're still trying to work with them to get them into ethanol plants and to farms and soy and biodiesel plants here in Iowa. So that's what our senior staff does. And what I'm doing is I'm meeting with local elected officials like yourselves, with community members as well, and one, educating them about the renewable fuel standard and biofuels, and also asking that you pledge your support of biofuels here in Iowa. What we're hoping to do is collect 50,000 pledges from Iowans across the state that we can take to these candidates who might be a little bit iffy about supporting biofuels here in Iowa, so that we can show them just this strong network of supporters so that they can see how important this is and that hopefully they will continue to support the RFS with whoever becomes elected president. And so I'm here asking you today for also your support as the Story County Supervisors to say, just to say that we support renewable fuels. We understand the importance of ethanol and biodiesel in Iowa. And, you know, if we get the chance to talk to any of the presidential candidates as they come through town, we'll also speak up about biofuels. And so that's basically what we are and what we're doing. I am open to any questions you have about our organization, about renewable fuels. Anything like that.
Well, the first question I have is, where'd you grow up?
I was actually born in Dallas, Texas, but I have lived all over Iowa all my life. My dad's a Methodist minister, and he's a minister now in Ames at Calvary United Methodist. So I live here in Ames as well. So,
well, you obviously seem to be a good spokesperson for the renewable energy future for Iowa.
Thank you.
As we all know, the big oil and is constantly raising issues, concern. Some of the big issues I understand is trying to attack the fact that we are using so much corn as a main product of this, and trying to link this to being more environmentally harming than the good that we're getting. How are we trying to counter that argument?
Yeah, and, you know, some of the issues are about the environmental impact is the amount of water usage to create, you know, a gallon of ethanol. And it takes about 3 gallons of water to produce a gallon of ethanol. But if you compare that to producing a gallon of oil, it can take up to 26 gallons of water. And we've been into the ethanol plants, spoke with plant managers, and actually they try and recycle as much of that water as they can. So it's not 3 gallons of water every time they start the process that they have to get brand new. So the water usage has actually been cut significantly since Iowa started producing ethanol, and there is that recycling of the water, and it's not nearly as much as gasoline. And then there's also some concerns about the nitrate runoff from the fields, and you know, there are definitely conservation practices that can be done by farmers that, you know, a lot of farmers are actually starting to do, like the terracing and doing the natural ditches to kind of help collect that runoff. So there are definitely environmental concerns, but, you know, when you really look at it, it's still, in the long run, much more environmentally friendly. So
my question is, have you picked up on anything, particularly from the EPA, in terms of maybe a negative in this particular area, or basically what agency, federal agency primarily, we need to be trying to lobby the most in this area?
It would definitely be the EPA. They're the one who sets the volume standards every year. And actually, the last 2 years, they did not set the standards. And they finally just set the standards this actually like a week and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And the standards were much lower than what Congress had hoped for, what our organization and what most Iowans had hoped for. And that can have a really large economic effect. The last 2 years when they didn't set any standards, farmers didn't know how much to plant, ethanol plants didn't know how much to produce. And as an effect of that, John Deere had to lay off 800 people because, you know, there just wasn't that economic, from that economic standpoint. So the EPA is definitely who we really need to talk to. And the president can hopefully put some pressure on the EPA to set the volume standards that we would like to see. So there's actually a feedback period right now after they just announced these new volume standards for blending in. And so we definitely encourage people to write into the EPA and let them know what they feel, that if they should increase the volumes a little bit more or decrease, but we would hope for an increase. So,
well, I would appreciate a short message or something that we could, for consistency's sake, mm-hmm. Use. The reason I say that is I represent the state of Iowa on the National Association of Counties Environmental Energy and Land Use Steering Committee.
Okay.
And we'll be in Mecklenburg, North Carolina this summer. And we will meet 2 days with our steering committee on environmental energy and so forth. And occasionally this topic comes up along with a lot of the others. And if there is maybe a little something that you could provide me beforehand that I could make sure that I bring up, because a lot of the legislations and things that we talk about is usually Gulf Coast, mm-hmm. or Pacific Coast or Atlantic Coast, and we're constantly trying to let them know that one size doesn't fit all,
yeah.
and that a lot of the things that they propose has a negative effect on farming and agricultural lands, and so we need more of a voice in that area. And our congressional delegation does a very good job, but you know they're in a minority,
yeah.
in many cases when it comes to issues like this. And I guess we may be too late for a resolution. I know mm-hmm. there was a period that we could have for as a resolution that could be submitted to our committee. I could just double check to see what that time frame is, but mm-hmm. any information that you might could get to me before I go out there, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I'll make sure that I bring it up as a point of topic or get it on the agenda.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can get you some talking points.
Right.
And we also have a did I send you the proclamation? Okay.
Yeah.
We also have a proclamation that just says, you know, we support renewable fuels because
right.
they do all these things for our county. So I can send that to all of you as well that you can have. And when is it that you leave?
In July, July 9th.
Okay, actually. Yeah, I can get right. you some things. Here this month. So
okay.
Great.
All right. Thank you.
Well, based on how it's on our agenda, first of all, appreciate so much the work you're doing and the battle that you're fighting. It is clearly really, really good for Iowa and Story County. Based on how it's on our agenda, I don't think we can take any formal action today, but there's no reason that each of us can't. Wayne, you've done a good job kind of sharing your thoughts. My thoughts are the RFS is necessary nationwide, but really, really good for Iowa and specifically good for Story County when you look at what we have here with REG and Lincoln Way Energy and the new DuPont plant coming online. So I'm, as I told you when we had coffee, I'm in full support. If there's ever anything I can do, please
okay.
let me know.
Great.
Paul, anything from you?
No, I think we've covered it.
All right.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next is introduction of Haley Smith, the regional director for Senator Joni Ernst. And Haley, come on up. We're so glad you're here. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And I'm going to have to tell you that usually when Senator Ernst always sees me, she gives me a hug. So when you're all done, am I expecting that from you too?
Than I am.
Oh,
good,
dog.
Good, very nice.
Well, I just started as Senator Ernst's regional director in the Des Moines office. The Des Moines region for Her state office has 23 counties, and I do the western 11 of those, including Story. Then there's another regional director, Matt, in our office, and he does the western portion of the region. She has 5 state offices. They're all fully staffed. They're all up and running. Kind of was a process there for a while, starting an office from scratch. But so we've got that now. My job really has 3 parts. I do a part casework if there are constituents that need help navigating federal agencies, someone struggling to get Veterans Affairs benefits, for example. That's something that I would be able to handle. The second part, I do liaison-type work. I'll come to meetings like this, and I want to hear feedback and anything I can pass along to the senator. I would be happy to do that. And then the third part is just attending meetings. If she is in the state, I will travel with her. I will, you know, arrange different meetings in the different areas. She does her 99-county tour, and I think she's 2/3 the way done so far, and she's only been in the Senate for a few months now. So we're making a lot of progress. And so, I'm really just here today to introduce myself, and if you have any specific concerns you would like me to pass on, I'm here to listen and pass anything on that you need.
Well, I guess the first question is, did you ride a Harley this Saturday? I think she had her roast and ride. Were you? Yeah.
No, I did not ride a Harley. I'm not ready for that.
Well, from my perspective, and I'll be out in D.C. here in a couple weeks, and actually one of our meetings is with the senator, and I'll share them then. But you just heard about the RFS. I think I know where Senator Ernst is on that, but please encourage her full support of that. And then we've got multiple issues, and I've actually got a little handout for you here on the issues that we're really interested in. We've been battling with the Corps of Engineers for a little while on a piece of ground here in Story County.
You're going to hear some good news about that.
Yeah, it's coming. That's right. But I still want to keep it on top of mind. The Iowa State Research Park is something that is really, really beneficial not only to this area but all of Iowa, and will have national repercussions. We want full support on that. Waters of the U.S., we feel like is really a problematic rule, especially when you get down to the agricultural world and what kind of regulations that would place on some of our farmers. And then making sure that transportation funding, specifically MAP 21 funding, is reauthorized, and we're able to maintain our infrastructure to the level we need to maintain it. Paul and Wayne, I'd ask if you guys have anything to add.
I think you've covered it.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you did a good job.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for coming over. I'll hand you this.
Okay.
You're welcome to stay, but please don't feel like it's necessary. Thank you.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
Mm-hmm. Additional items, consideration of a mass notification system in the administration building. We have Joey Moore here today to talk to us about that.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Start off there. Introduction, who you are and who you're with.
Joey Moore.
Let's get you in the microphone because we're recording everything.
We're recording this.
You're recording? Okay. I don't usually walk into counties to do that.
My name is Joey Moore. I'm with SecureTech Systems in Dallas, Texas. We've been in business since 1995, and we have over 2,000 county courthouses nationwide. I know you guys are looking at the administration building, but government buildings, courthouses, what have you. We're also in the school space as well. We do some community colleges and things like that, so... The original founder is still with the company. I've been with the company for 6 years. And lots of travel. Took a little hiatus for a few years, but came back. So hand you my cards now?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. There you go, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So,
I'm going to do a little demo here because it's much easier for me to show you how this works than me sit here and explain it. I originally met with the detention supervisor, John Asmussen,
mm-hmm.
and that was several years ago. That was probably, 4 years ago. He really liked the system at the time. You guys were going through some changes, and it just wasn't the right time, but... since then, the system's actually changed quite a bit. The biggest deal with this system is there's several advantages. One is it's a totally wireless system. I know your facilities guy will probably like that. Secondly, there's no monthly fee with our system. And third, I would say, is the biggest part of our system is the instant notification factor. And I'll show you how that works here in a second. But what it does is it skips dispatch and has a pre-recorded message directly to the sheriff department's radios. And, you know, we can do up to 4 radio frequencies. So you can also have the Nevada local PD on there as well as, like, second responders or, you know, however you guys want to work that. But I'll show you how this works. As I mentioned, it's totally wireless. So even the sensors that we have, you know, standard panic buttons like this. We can also put buttons on the computer, virtual buttons like icons. We also have motion sensors, trip beams. We did the United Center in Chicago doing pressure mats. They were having some people steal some liquor. That's just one example of one of the sensors we have. So give this just a minute to turn on. It's got a battery backup on it, which it's running off of now, so it lasts about 3 days. So if you guys were to ever lose power in the building, you know, it would still be working for a few days. So let's say somebody came into, you know, one of the courtrooms and was giving somebody a problem and you know, the judge or what have you decided to hit this button. If they felt threatened, well, immediately you would get, oh, I got to arm my system. That would probably be helpful. So, again, if they were to hit this button, you would immediately get a message.
Law enforcement assistance needed. Courtroom 1.
So, you can have, the default is 2 times. Law enforcement. Hence the instant notification. A lot of times, you know, dispatch, yeah, it's great, you know, but it takes some time. It takes 30, 45 seconds. For that dispatcher to get that message, call to the correct person, and then that correct person to go find, you know, where the auditor, what's going on in the auditor's office or courtroom or treasurer or what have you. But obviously the nice thing here is that you guys are a little bit bigger county than most counties. I heard the girls say that the center's been to 90-something counties. I've been to 84 in 6 years, so I'm slacking a little bit. But most of the counties, you know, some of the smaller counties don't always have, you know, an officer in the courtroom or in the administration building. You guys are set up a little different, obviously. But, you know, it can work where, you know, if they're on a call, if they're responding to something, you know, pretty serious, it'll still hit their radios because we'll just go over the radio frequency. Another thing I want to mention, it's actually pretty valuable as well. I know that a lot of the counties here in Iowa are going through different trainings, Alert, Alice, what have you. And this system here, we can now set it up to where we can also send emails and text messages. So the folks who do not have radios, you know, just pretty much everybody except the sheriff and police, would be able to get that message too, and then you guys could go through your protocol as to what you do at that point in time, you know, when that button's hit. So that's pretty much it. It's got a computer interface as well, so you can actually access this box through a computer. You don't have to actually be physically present by the box. The computer interface is just a little portal, just a login that you go through, and everything you see on this box, it's all touchscreen. So everything you see on this box is the exact same thing that you see on the computer.
Well, a couple things. First of all, the notification, the message that came out. If you were in an office scene and you do hit the panic button, does that sound occur right then, or does it just go right to whoever your dispatch officers is concerned? And the reason I'm asking that question, first of all, because if I was sitting there and I hit it and I've got someone who's trouble, and if that sound says, well, officer is being dispatched, I'm not sure what my reaction may be if I was intent on creating some harm.
Oh, no. The assailant or what have you would not know that the button was pushed. It would go directly to, unless somebody obviously was in there with the radio, they would hear it across the radio. But, all that would happen, and, you know, you actually have to hold this thing down for a good second for it to go. So there's no, like, accidental hitting the button or anything like that. But to answer your question, no, the person in the office would not know that the button was being
hit. Well, second question, we do have some of our key people here that are listening to your presentation, our IT director, our emergency management director, one of our key assistants in facility management and so forth. My question, again, looking at the box like that, how many of those would necessarily have to happen? Would the low panic button have to be in each office, each computer? Kind of give me a little of a idea of the schematic design in order for something like that to be effective for our facilities as large as this building. Now, we have this building, we have the Justice Center, and several other buildings. So if we were talking trying to make sure that we had something like this countywide, you know, I can see it being somewhat extensive. So just from your standpoint, could you give me just a brief idea of the logistics of that box? Do you need several of those plus all the panic buttons?
No, you wouldn't need several boxes. There's a few different ways we do it now. So typically in a building this size, I'm not exactly sure how many buttons you guys would need, but one box would be able to cover this building no problem. There's a couple different options outside of this building, if you wanted to do something countywide, like you said. We have the, as I mentioned, we have the virtual panic buttons on the computer that we would run over your network with. So we could do it that way. Or the second option would be to get a remote module, which acts and does everything the box does, except it's not the box, and hence it's quite a bit less expensive. But those are for people that, you know, maybe 3 miles away still want the hard panic button to be able to hit. So, you know, there's a couple different ways to do it, you know, under that scenario. I would also mention that as far as how many buttons you guys would need, it's kind of up to you. I mean, we have some counties, for example, a county you guys' size, Linn County is actually, one of our clients, and so is, Woodbury County is about to be, but basically, some of the things that they're looking at is, or that they've done, they've strategically placed them in, let's say in the auditor's office, you have 4 or 5 employees. Well, they wanted each employee to have a button under their desk, where we could just put like a little double-sided piece of tape, that would adhesive, that would stick and everything. But, each person wanted their own button. Whereas in the treasurer's office, this being in Linn County, they had 2 folks up at the front, and they thought they only needed 2 buttons, which was fine. And then there's some people right now. I'm also working. Clay County is one of our customers. They've been a customer for ours for a while, and they actually had the original box back in '95. But we're working on an upgrade right now where they want redundancy, so they want some of the folks not only to have the virtual panic button on their computer, but they also want them to have a hard button. So it's kind of to each his own. I mean, it's, we would come in and do a site survey and kind of get everybody's feedback to see, what people were looking at, what they wanted, and we would make it, feasible. We'd customize it to what you guys want, basically. Does that answer your question?
Yes, okay. Yes, it does. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Can you give us some idea of cost of doing a system for a building like this? And I know it would vary depending on what kind of features we wanted and how many of the panic buttons and things like that. But
sure,
general idea.
Yeah, so the box itself, it's all standard. The box itself runs $8,000. That's a one-time cost. Each hard button, just like this, the standard panic button, is $125 a piece. And the virtual panic buttons on the computer are $60 a piece. The remote module that I was talking about earlier, which is just like the box, can act like the box, that is $3,200. And
what's the range on that?
So the range on the remote module would be the same as the body. It would be 200 feet. So now it wouldn't be the remote module from the buttons to the remote module. Sorry. So the remote module to the box is actually we would go over your network as well. So it's as expansive as your network is. Yeah.
Okay. And that box communicates through dispatch, even though it doesn't stop at dispatch, communicates through dispatch over the network.
You can have it do that. It would still communicate through the through the network, through the radios, and via email.
Right, but how's the signal getting from the box to the radios is my question.
RF.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, no monthly fee after that. That's out the door. We do a 2-year warranty, which this is all firmware. This runs on firmware, so that would include firmware. Another nice feature I'll tell you guys about too is, you know, obviously these buttons, they have lithium batteries in them, and they're gonna get low, they're gonna die eventually. So the box will actually send out an email or text to whoever you want. We can do distribution lists or however you guys want to set that up. And the person who's maintaining the box will get a text or email saying, hey, button, you know, such and such in the auditor's office is getting low. At that point in time, you have about a month. It says it's got about 10% left, I think is what the message says. So you got about a month to change it at that point. The other thing is that, you know, a question I get a lot is, you know, how do we know if the buttons work? Well, the buttons are actually, the box itself is actually pinging or checking in with the buttons every 15 minutes. Obviously, that's transparent to, you know, you guys. We don't want to annoy you with, hey, the button's working or the button's not working. Well, the button's not working. You will get a email text saying, hey, button, you know, 42 in the auditor's office. And then, you know, on this screen, you can actually customize it to where it's, you know, Mr. Smith or whoever's in the auditor's office working, you can actually customize it to their name so you can know exactly where it is. You don't have to go through a sheet and figure out what button 42 is. So the box has actually come a long way from the last version. So, and this is probably going to be the last version for a while, for the foreseeable future. So,
next steps for Story County, if Story County wanted to go down this path?
So what I would do, you know, I'm here in Iowa every 2 weeks. I come up here and, you know, I can come up and do a site survey, kind of figure out, you know, get with the right folks and figure out, okay, you know, where do you want the buttons? How many buttons do you need? And what that site survey would also include would be me basically just walking around with this radio and testing it, putting the box where you guys, you know, would want the box. You know, obviously you want to keep it out of where the public can see it, because the only thing that can defeat the system is if somebody, like, destroys the box. So you don't want that to happen, obviously. But so I'd just walk around and just test it in various parts of the building just to make sure it works. In this building, you know, we did Sioux City out there in Woodbury has an 8-story building, which you guys may know about. It's a lot of steel, a lot of stone, a lot of everything. And actually, we don't even need a repeater in that building, which was – so if we don't need one in there, I 99.9% sure we wouldn't in here, but we would still do the site survey just to make sure. And, you know, if you guys were wanting to test other facilities too, you know, I would make a you know, spend some time out here with you guys and go out and test those as well. So,
so you hit the panic button and the radio message goes twice.
Yeah, you can make it go as many times as you want, okay. But yeah.
So then you hit it again because it's going to get hit more than once.
Sure.
The message is going to repeat itself. I assume this will go through dispatch, so they'll be able to hear it also.
Oh,
so
sure. Then, yeah.
Can you set that to follow up with an email or just, I mean, you know, I don't want to have somebody hitting that button and have the message go out because I spent 30 years in a squad car. I know how things go. If you miss, you know, it's like, wow, what was that? You know, I didn't hear that. Or
oh, right.
So I want to make sure that if the system is in place that, you know, that the radio message goes out twice, but that needs to be followed up through our local sheriff's office dispatch, whether it's the sheriff's, you know, officers himself or it's Nevada PD here. So is that something that system's capable of doing?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Another thing I'll mention too, I'm not sure what you guys, it's been a while since I've talked to, Mr. Asmussen, but, do you guys have a camera system currently now or any other type of system in here? Or?
We can't tell you that.
Okay. Well, the reason that I ask is
That's
is,
<doing. laughs>
You know, I'm from Texas. We carry guns. No, so basically, the reason I ask is this box here, it's got four inputs in it. So we can actually integrate with any system you have. I'll give you a perfect example. In Mahaska County, they have a camera system, and their cameras are always running, but they're not always recording. So they had an incident, this was years ago, in I believe it was the treasurer's office where someone just came in, court clerk's office, and they had a camera in there, and when somebody hit the button, we were able to integrate with their camera system where we were able to blow it up on the dispatch's screen to say, hey, this is what's going on in here. And of course they got the message and the email and all that. But, so yeah, I mean, that's just another thing the box can do. You know, it's unlimited emails, unlimited texts, unlimited buttons that you can put on the box. So there's no limit to that, and there's no extra cost except for the cost of just the buttons. You know, whether you have 1,000 emails or 100 emails makes no difference cost wise. It's kind of up to you what you guys want to do. So, to reiterate, yes, we can send a email, text, a different message across. Yeah. So
I would suggest that the next step for us is to have you on one of your future visits get together with probably Big John, but somebody from the sheriff's office, definitely Cal, definitely Barb, and there may be others that I'm missing there, but then go around in this building from office to office and department to department and have the conversation and see what our setup would be and how it would integrate with everything that the sheriff's office and dispatch would be doing, and then see where it goes from there.
Yep.
Wayne, do you see it differently than that, or is that... So that I know we've got Barb, I know we've got, since you're here and Cal's not, can I ask that you lead the conversation of getting you guys all back together next time he's in the area and start to have this conversation? I know I'm intrigued. The price point doesn't seem terrible if it does what it, you say it does, and it's something we've been talking about for a few years around here.
Yeah.
So, good.
So can you tell me the price is too low, or
no? I like the price. Yeah, too high. I'd have bought today if you'd have been lower. But
we'll talk about trying to make that a little bit more easier to swallow.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Oh, okay, cool.
All right. That gets us to consideration of minutes from both May 26th and June 2nd.
Move approval second. Of both 26th and the 2nd.
Motion and a second. Corrections or additions? Clinton?
Aye.
Toot?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Minutes pass. All right. Consideration of personnel actions. Please add one action form for the attorney's office and one for the Board of Supervisors.
Move approval with no additions.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. All right. Consent agenda. Let's start with the additions. We got addition of road closure 1556 and addition of utility permit 1571. And then we would like to pull item number 7, which is resolution 1579, for discussion. And we'd like to pull item number 14, which is consideration of agreement with the City of Zeering, for discussion.
Move approval with noted changes.
Second.
Have a motion and a second. Clinton.
Aye.
Toot.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Consent agenda passes with the noted changes. So let's go to consideration of resolution 1579. And Deb, I think
I'm going to ask Deb if she would come up to the mic and join me, please. Join us. Mm-hmm. For the benefit of the audience and so forth, I received some communication through the National Association of Counties regarding the Stepping Up initiative, and thought that it was certainly something that was what we had been talking about through our mental health region regarding jail diversion and other programs to reduce the number of people with mental illness in jail. And I felt that by sharing this with Deb And we agreed that we would bring this before the Regional Governance Board. Then after we got their go-ahead and approval to bring it back to the Board of Supervisors, and the Stepping Up initiative really is where counties across America is asked to join in support of this initiative. And one of the first counties in our area to do this was Douglas County, Nebraska. And before I ask Deb to comment a little bit about the Regional Governance Board position and discussion that we had, I'll just share with you Commissioner Marianne Borgen's statement. She said, "Our jails serve more people with mental illness than any other institution in Nebraska. While we have already launched a successful mental health diversion program and other initiatives, we know we have more work to do. That is why I was proud that our Board of Commissioners was one of the first in the country to pass a resolution to support Stepping Up. Together we can provide a better alternative for our loved ones with mental health conditions." And so what is before us is a form of a resolution that Deb has worked on to adapt to Fitzroy County if it is approved, and then it would be forwarded on to the National Association of Counties, and Story County would be recognized along with other counties in Iowa that have joined this call to action in passing this resolution. So, Deb, any thoughts, comments you'd like to make in regard to that? And thank you for your hand in reformatting the resolution also.
Sure. Thank you. Yes, we talked about this at the governing board meeting a couple of weeks ago. They were in support of taking it back to the individual member counties for approval. That way, those counties will be recognized through NACO as supportive of this initiative. Of course, our region is supportive of it. I think the whole part of mental health redesign is supportive of jail diversion and other kinds of services for individuals who are incarcerated or stepping back into the community and needing support as they do so. Just quickly, three areas, and it's on the first page of the initiative, but three areas that the Central Iowa Community Services region is working on is access to psychiatric care. We're doing that in a couple of ways. One, we're funding crisis appointments at our mental health centers so that if someone is in a crisis and needs that evaluation, they can get in right away without having to wait. Here in Story County, we're working with Ireley Ball on that, and we have two appointments a week that are available for that purpose. We're also working with integrated telehealth partners to bring telehealth into our jails and or our county hospital ERs. Here in Story County, we're working with Story County Medical Center to bring that service to them so that they can provide some basic screening services for individuals who show up there for mental health services. And as you know, the Story County Jail already has that service in place through their medical contract, so that will continue. The region is also funding mental health first aid training to officers and other stakeholders in the community. Here in Story County, we are using trainers through Youth and Shelter Services to provide both the adult module and the youth module, and there have been approximately five trainings held between January and June. So we look at continuing that into the next fiscal year. And then lastly, and you'll be happy about this as well, we have got our jail diversion program back up and going with the contract through Optima Life Services. They have a full-time intensive case manager on staff. This went into effect May 1st, and the first 2 weeks of this person's job with Optima, he had 12 clients. So we're looking at that continuing to grow, and Optima is already talking about adding another full-time intensive case manager, and then at some point bringing that out to the rest of the member counties. So, and we'll look for other kinds of services and support that can be provided regionally to individuals who have mental health and substance abuse issues and are involved in the judicial system.
Deb, thank you. Wayne, thank you for making sure we had an opportunity to talk this through and share its import of why we are acting on the Resolution 1579 as we are. With that, would you care to make the motion?
Yes, I would move the adoption of Resolution 1579, where we would be participating in the NACO Stepping Up Initiative to reduce the number of people with mental illness in jails.
And I'll second that motion.
Any further discussion?
No, I would just encourage people to go to our website and actually look at the resolution. The content is somewhat lengthy, but I think it really speaks to the comments that Deb has mentioned and also what we are doing as a region to reduce the number of people with mental illness in our jails.
Outstanding. Thank you. Clinton?
Aye.
Toot?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Resolution 1579 passes. Thank you, Deb.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deb.
Additional items number two. We don't have public hearing items today. Additional items number two. Discuss.
Yeah, number 14.
Yeah, skip 14.
Yeah,
sorry about that. I got ahead of myself. Number 14 that we pulled from consent agenda is wastewater collection and water supply services from the City of Zeering agreement between Story County and Zeering. Mike Cox.
Yeah, thanks for pulling this from consent for some discussion. Just wanted to clarify, the reason we wanted it to be pulled is just clarify an administrative item on it. The agreement states that the board would pass it by passing a resolution. That resolution is not necessary. So what I would request is that the board consider this and approve this agreement without a resolution but by motion to accept the agreement.
So just a change in wording, not by resolution, but just by approving by motion.
Yep. Correct.
Any questions or comments?
No, I would make the motion that we approve the agreement with the City of Zeering for water supply and wastewater collection.
Second.
We have a motion and second. Further discussion? Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Agreement passes. Mike, thanks. Now we can move on to additional items number two. And we are discussing and considering a revised Story County Financial Policies 7-day review.
Yes, good morning.
Lucy Martin. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, I'm actually bringing three policies to you today. So just a little background and context on that. We had revised the travel policy earlier this year. We have new election equipment, so we were looking at that. We need to revise our election security policy. And it's just a good idea to every once in a while go through these. And now the revised policies reflect those changes. So I had sent updated dates for the first adopted for both the financial and purchasing policy. So the which I had emailed to you yesterday. That was the only change I had made to the documents that were in the agenda. So we'll start with the financial policies. I had the first adopted date for this version was actually June 3rd of 2008. There was actually a predecessor policy called the financial reporting policy, which was adopted in November 26th of 2002. That was in response to GASB 34, which really was sort of a watershed moment to standardize reporting for local governments. So if you don't mind, I'll just go through the changes that I made on this. At the bottom of page two, there's now a reference to the reporting standards and fund types from GASB 54, which was a new statement, so that has been included. On page three, due to mental health redesign, we changed the wording for our mental health fund, and now it conforms to that code section and our 28E agreement. On the fourth page, I just did some clarification on the $5,000 threshold and how that affects department heads and elected officials, how they should present that to in a public meeting. And in response to an audit comment that we received, we've added clarification about the documentation of public purpose when we use when we have food and beverages at a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
see, and then under the debt management policy, I added tax increment financing revenue bonds, which were not included in the last version of this document. So I've also just, I did not give you a marked up version because I made so many formatting changes that would have been impossible to read. I have tried to make all of the policies look the same so that employees know when they're reading a policy that's what it looks like. So that's what I had for financial policies. And this will go out to all the departments, elected officials for 7-day review for comments.
Yeah, well, I'll just say the formatting looks great. The content, I'm so appreciative that you would go through and make sure that our policies actually match what we're doing and intending to do. That's always convenient when those two things come together. And I mean, I think if I'm not mistaken, Lucy, and you might be able to correct me if I'm wrong. The auditor's office was recognized back in 2008 or 2009 for the got some kind of recognition for
the GFOA, the Government Financial Officers Association, for our budgets, and this was part of the process that we had updated policies and reporting. So yeah. It's always nice to when you're the county that people say, do you have policies that we can look at? Because we need to do them too, as opposed to being the one to ask. So
let's deal with financial policies, and then we'll move on to purchasing.
I would move approval of the revised financial policy.
Second.
Motion
and
a second.
For 7-day review.
Mm-hmm. For 7-day review. Motion and a second. Any further discussion? Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Financial policies are approved pending 7-day review. Next is purchasing policy.
All right. The purchasing policy, I did change the first adopted date, which is 4/17/2001. And then so the last revised would be the 12/21/2010. For this document, most of the changes were stylistic. I rearranged the way the information flowed. It didn't really change a lot of the information. For instance, on the first page, the definition, there were definitions in there that were never used in the document, so I took them out. There were also definitions that we used that weren't defined, so I went ahead. For instance, like lease purchase was not defined, so I added that. So that's that page. There are numerous references to code sections, so those were all checked. And a lot of it was just moving paragraphs around to make it flow better. If a document is easy to read, then people are much more likely to read it.
Mm-hmm.
The purchasing threshold, that was just reorganized sort of into subsections that were easier to understand. Put in some clarifying language about who is responsible for legal publications or adding things to the board's agenda. On the exemptions, there was some weird language there, which I think was a cut and paste from another county, so that was clarified. And what I removed from this within the policy itself, there were sort of footnotes about attorney general opinions, and I've actually pulled those out and made a sort of an appendix for that. So that can be updated without updating the entire policy. AG opinions come out sort of irregularly, so I didn't want that to trigger an entire rewrite of the policy. And then the reason we have a purchasing policy is mostly because I don't want to say that we didn't have policies beforehand. We had a lot of memoranda, and also sort of most of what we do is dictated by the Code of Iowa. But in response to a federal and state grants that we were getting, they wanted to see a longer purchasing policy that didn't just say like, yeah, we do whatever the state and federal code says. So I took a really hard look at the grant guidance section here, and that was since the federal government has revised some of its standards, I revised ours as well and made sure that all of those OMB circulars and code of federal regulations were up to date. So that's really the purchasing policy in a nutshell, if you had any questions.
Okay. No.
Do not.
I would move consideration of the revised purchasing policy pending 7-day review.
Second.
Motion and a second to approve the purchasing policy on 7-day review. Further discussion. Clinton.
Aye.
Toot.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Purchasing policy passes for 7-day review.
Oh, I should say that Jessica Reynolds did review all of these policies, and I got a response from her last Friday that she had no legal questions. So that was good. That was good to know. I should have led with that.
Yes. we assume that.
Election security policy.
Right. The election security policy, we have had one of these. It was part of a code change written into the Iowa Administrative Code in response to the federal HAVA legislation. This is the first time we're actually I'm actually bringing it to you to adopt as a county policy. If you look at its history, it's gone through as an additional item. It's gone through as a consent agenda item, and the last few times it's gone through as a resolution. Since election security not only affects the auditor's office, but I ask other departments to sign our policy and adhere to our standards, I feel much more comfortable adopting it as a county policy. So this will be the first time we do that. The policy itself, the changes from the previous version, I stripped out all specific references to our equipment, because equipment can change, but our policy will not change. Our security standards will not change. And so I wanted to make it a workable. You know, let's say we had a breakdown of equipment and we had to borrow something else, then it's covered under our security policy.
Mm-hmm.
So I will be asking not just my own staff to sign, but also anybody that has access to our secure areas. Where we store equipment and ballots. So that's pretty straightforward.
Yep. I would move approval of the revised election security policy pending the 7-day review.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion. Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Security election security policy passes pending 7-day review. Still with Lucy, revised confiscation scale for precinct election officials.
All right. So we redid the election security policy with our new equipment. We're looking at all of the things we do across elections, and that includes the compensation for our temporary election workers. What you'll see in this memo, the only two changes are the first two, which are the precinct chairperson and the precinct official. All the others, I'm not asking for any change. That's those are what we compensate them now, and I'm not asking to change that. I think when we first started, back before we had Election Day registration, back before we had a lot of specialized machinery, back before we had laptops at the precinct, the election worker that was working at your standard residential precinct was given a book, given some ballots. People come in, you check them off, you hand them a ballot, they put it in the machine. It's pretty straightforward. Now we ask our election officials in the precincts to do a lot more specialized things, like we ask the absentee board, like we ask our office temps, like we ask satellite workers. So I wanted to bring their salaries in line with what we pay those people, because they're all doing sort of specialized things and need not that it was easier to be a precinct election official, but it's a little more straightforward. I mean, it was still a long day. It was still dealing with the, you know, lots of voter questions, but it's not as straightforward as it used to be, so I wanted to bring that in line.
What were we paying?
We were paying $8 for the chair and $7.25. The code mandates that we pay at least minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at other counties. There was a survey done in this past January, which had 66 counties responding to that, and we are paying under what is standard across the board. If you look at counties that are more like Story County, their pay scale is more in the $12 to $15 range. So I want to, not that we have to do exactly what other counties do, but it's very common to pay in this $10 to $10.50 an hour range. We're also dealing with, while I have a very reliable pool of election officials, that is shrinking every day. That's a retired population. And this is not just a Story County problem. It's not just an Iowa problem. This is a national problem of trying to replace those retired people when they pass away. I think that level of civic duty is not sort of ingrained in younger generations, or those people are just essentially busier, and they have kids, they have older parents, they have jobs, they have second jobs. So we're trying to recruit people to come on. I think the people that reliably work for us, they don't do it for the money, but to attract new people, we have to try to get people in here. So this is one way to do that.
Well, and we need to do what's fair.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if we had used these rates in the election last November, it would have cost $12,000 more to hold that election. I will say we did sustainable cuts, so not just in this past election, but going forward. We cut, $102,000 out of that last election from what we had budgeted based on our old way of doing things. And with new equipment and with just sort of rethinking how we do things, those are sustainable cuts. For this upcoming year, the schools and cities, if we do this raise, it will be a wash for what we did before because we'll have savings, but we'll also be paying our election workers more. Election workers, traditionally that runs to be anywhere between 40 to 60% of an election cost, so it's not a small portion, but we have made some real gains in other areas, which we will see for all elections. And we also budgeted the primary using sort of our past practices to make that budget. So that's why I'm asking that we do it this year, and then when we do the FY17 budget, we can build it into the budget. But for now, I think it's already built into our expected costs. It's just a shift of where those costs are going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
So,
questions?
Nope. I move approval of the compensation scale for precinct election officials as submitted.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion. Clinton.
Aye.
Toot.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Passes. Thanks, Lucy. Final item from Lucy is consideration of revised compensation scale for township officials.
Right. So we're looking at scale for election officials. So then we're like, what about township officials? Our township officials are currently compensated at a rate of $5 per hour. Unlike the election officials, that's not pegged to minimum wage. We spend typically anywhere from $1,100 to $1,800 a year on township official wages. So it works out to be about anywhere between $500 to $900 a year difference if we increase it to the minimum wage. So,
questions?
This year we've spent about $1,100 so far on township officials. Last year we spent about $1,900, the year before that, about $1,800. It just depends the who submits a timesheet.
Well, I assume they can submit a claim for any time they spend.
Yeah, there are exceptions. You know, if they're doing fence viewing, other thing, that's not a claimable. I'm going to look at the code section here. So, like, if they're assessing, like, trespassing of animals or fence viewing, then that's not covered because that's covered under a different portion of their compensation. Then that gets paid somewhere else. But this portion actually gets paid by the county for their sort of regular attendance of meetings.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, Lisa.
Typically we have, like, less than half of them. Half of the townships actually submit for any hours that they think of it also as a civic duty, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't want to raise it too high, then they'll all start submitting claims. So, I would move approval of the.
It's just been a long time since we've looked at this rate.
Compensation for township trustees.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Revised compensation schedule for township officials passes. Thank you, Lucy. Good job.
We'll see you next week.
Yeah.
Discussion and consideration of revision to the asset policies and procedures. Deb Shildroth. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
Well, this will be quick because we have just some minor changes on page 3, and hopefully it printed out this way for you. We are having the region, since they are a funder in the asset process, we are having them appoint their own volunteers. And so that's what the change is within the team structure, is that there will be 3 volunteers from the region instead of 5. And the reason for the 3 is because on panels, we have 4 panels in asset. Panels 1, 2, and 4 have the mental health and disability services. Panel 3 is all children's services, and it's not involving any mental health dollars. So that's why we thought we would just have the 3 volunteers coming from the region. And I'm happy to say that we have 2 out of the 3 volunteers selected already. So we're moving along with that. And then the other change is on pages 8 and 10. It's the same change. We're just clarifying the name of the empowerment area so that we're correctly calling it BOOST, Together for Children, instead of, I think we had in there before, just the early childhood Iowa area board. So we want to correctly name that BOOST, Together for Children. So that's on pages 8 and 10.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the conclusion of the corrections of the policies, and the asset administrative team approved these, so now it goes on to each funder.
Okay. Questions?
No.
I would move approval of the revisions to the asset policies and procedures.
Second.
Motion and second. Further discussion? 2.
Aye.
Clinton?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Asset policies and procedure passed. Thanks, Deb. Discussion consideration of revised HIPAA policies and procedures and recovery plans.
All right. A little bit larger document here, and I just want to give some background as to why this is before you today. There were HIPAA changes introduced at the federal level in 2013. The majority of those changes have to do with security policies and electronic information. And as a result of these new changes, ISAC packaged HIPAA services for the counties. So instead of having each county kind of out there on their own trying to figure out how to implement these changes, ISAC stepped up and said, here's a package of HIPAA services that counties can purchase. And the services included policy templates, consultation, and training. And our Mental Health and Disability Services region decided to purchase what we're calling 2 memberships from ISAC to offer then to the member counties in our region. And then the region is taking responsibility for putting together the templates and then coming out and doing the training to appropriate staff. So that's what you have before you today. What we've had to include, there's several documents. This is the largest one, 200 and some page one. But there were a couple of other documents that we had to include, and that was from LightEdge, which is the entity working with ISAC on the Community Services Network, and that's the system that Community Services uses for their mental health and disability services, their tracking, their budget information, all of that stuff. So we had to include that in here. We also had to include, because of the insurance that Story County offers to our employees, we had to include the privacy policies for Coventry and Principal and is it Avius, coverage. So we had to include that in here as well. Counties are designated as a hybrid entity under the HIPAA law, and the following offices within the county are designated as healthcare components. That would be the auditor's office, attorney's office, board of supervisors, veterans affairs, information technology, and community services. So we're all involved in terms of security and privacy kinds of things. And those offices that have not been designated as a healthcare component are not subject to the HIPAA provisions, but they still have to follow appropriate confidentiality guidelines, so training will be offered on for that as well. Our privacy and security officer is Alyssa Wignall, and following the approval of the policies, training will be scheduled, and we'll have individuals from the region coming out to provide training to staff. So any questions or comments?
No, but I think she covered it well.
Outstanding.
I would move the adoption of the revised HIPAA policies and procedures as submitted.
Second. We have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Clinton?
Aye.
Two?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. HIPAA policies and procedures passed. Thanks, Deb.
Thank you.
That is a big document. Next item is consideration of appointing a representative from Story County Board of Supervisors for the Central Iowa CEO Board effective until the end of this calendar year. If you'll recall, several weeks ago, we voted to join the Central Iowa Workforce Investment Board. Now we need to have one of the three of us represent Story County on that board. And the vision here is that this appointment will only last the rest of this calendar year, and then we'll handle it in our organizational meeting every year like we handle the rest of these.
Those goes. I nominate Rick Sanders.
Second.
All right. Further discussion. Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Done.
Congratulations.
Oh, I'm just so excited. Thank you. Consideration of amendment to the Shive Hattery Professional Services Agreement for Dakin's Lake Expansion, which we got to be close to done with this now, aren't we?
Very close. Very close.
All right.
Very close. So, yeah, by the way, not what I'm here to talk about here, but you all know that the dedication for Dakin's Lake is June 27th at 10:30 in the morning. So, look forward to seeing you there. This amendment secures the services of our Shive Hattery engineer, our Dakin's Lake engineer, Shive Hattery, to design a trail connection from the lake to the Prairie Rail Trail. So essentially we take it from the lake on the north side of Ziering, find a route through Ziering, and then design the trail to connect to the end of the Prairie Rail Trail, which is at Highway 65.
Ends on the west side of 65.
On the west side of 65, correct. So we own land from the highway, from 65 into about where the elevator is. So it would be, that's the old railroad right away. So it would be designing that portion of the trail, finding a route to connect to the park. So that's what this agreement does, or this amendment does. It was funded through, we designated funding through our FY16 budget. So this agreement is coming in under what we budgeted. We budgeted, I believe, $60,000, and this agreement is at $33,000. So I would the Conservation Board discussed this last night, and they're recommending approval of this amendment.
I think it's a necessary component to what we've done out at Dakin's Lake, start to tie it together with our whole trail system. I know it's something, Mike, that we had talked about early in the process of trying to find a way to tie in. Questions from you guys?
No, I think it's a good move. That,
yeah.
I mean, that trail has been there for a good number of years, and it just, it stopped right there at Highway 65. Yeah. And I think the people in Ziering will be very happy to see that trail come into town.
Yep, yeah. Good.
You have a motion.
Yep, I would move approval of the Shive Hattery Professional Service Agreement for the Dakin's Lake Expansion.
Second.
Motion and a second. Further discussion. Mike, anything to add?
No, thank you.
Clinton.
Aye.
Two.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Amendment to the Shive Hattery Professional Service Agreement passes. Next is consideration of a bid to award Smith Seating for Hickory Grove Watershed. Mike.
Very good. Thank you again. We opened bids last week. We received three bids on this project. The low bid was from Smith Seating Incorporated. At $402,869.26. What the Conservation Board is recommending is that we award the base bid only and not the alternate. So that's what we're requesting here today, to award the project to Smith Seating. we've got, as far as the funding for this project goes, we received $405,000 in grants for this project. All said and done, on our costs right now, we are at $513. What the Conservation Board last night approved is to recommend to you that we move forward, we award this project. The Conservation Board would fund half of that difference, and with the difference being $50,000, and or approximately $50,000, and request that the Board of Supervisors fund the other half of that difference. So it brings the half of the difference being from what we budgeted to what the costs come in at. Brings the Board of Supervisors contribution to $53,843, and the Conservation Board's contribution to that same amount.
And Board, so you know, we had budgeted $27,302 for this for FY16, so it would mean an increase to the $53,000 mark. But as Mike rightly points out, we got over $400,000 in grants paying for a $500,000 project, and something that we've been working on for a long time.
And, yes, this was a considerable discussion last evening at the Conservation Board meeting, and I think they clearly looked at, you know, what this will do and why we needed to move forward at this time. This has been something that we've been dealing with for some time, and so I felt that the adjustments that we had through the funding stream merited a recommendation for us. And, Rick, I would agree that we have come to recognize that sometimes the engineering estimate cost oftentimes is coming in a little bit lower than the actual cost. But I think this is a project that we should fully move forward and get done. So I would certainly move that we approve award the bid to Smith Seeding for the Hickory Grove Watershed Project, which is the base bid in the project.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Clinton?
Aye.
Toot?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. We award the Smith Seeding. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Next is consideration of the COOP COG process and timeline, but we're going to take a 2-minute recess before that.
Okay.
Ready, Shell? All right, we're back in, and we're with Leanne Harder, who's talking to us about COOP COG, which is kind of fun to say. Tell us what it is.
Good morning. I am going to go over a few slides, just a background of what COOP COG is, and then ask for some direction this morning from the Board of Supervisors. COOP COG is, as Rick said, a fun acronym, but does stand for something as continuity of operations and continuity of government. And COOP COG is way easier to say, though, and maybe understand. There's some purpose statements for both of these, and really when it comes down to it, it's to ensure the continuity of essential functions. That's where you see continuity in both those statements. So that in any not normal disruptions that could occur, if a building were to be destroyed or we would lose energy, whatever it may be, we may continue those essential functions. It serves as a baseline for preparedness. And it is something that all county governments should have. Benefits are numerous. The five up there on the slide are probably the most obvious, but there are benefits that go untold as well. Anticipate threats, adapt to sudden changes, increase operational performance, determine vital resources, and improve communications. That being said, also, we have a human resource element. As employees of Story County, having a COOP COG in place will help set that baseline and assurances if something were to happen that we can continue, and in some cases continue to get paid too, because that does present a concern to many. This is an interesting study that was done in 2005-2006 that released in 2006. About 900 plus businesses throughout the United States were surveyed in regards to their continuity of operations. And this just demonstrates where the weakest links are. Again, these are businesses, but the business continuity model definitely is applicable to government continuity as well. Over 30% is the weakest link is the people, whether or not they can get to the employment, how they can do their jobs in a continuing manner, and so forth. Process is next, 26%. Technology, again, this was 2006, so this may be somewhat dated. I'd be interested to see if they're going to redo the study, but even that's going to hover around the 20% mark and probably be increasing at this point. Supply chain partner risk, where we get our commodities to do our day-to-day business. Collaboration with private industries, and then our data risk. And again, with the dataness of this, I think that may have increased as well. But it does show one of our greatest assets is our people as a county entity, and so we need to make sure that we plan accordingly. Just some highlights. It's a process. KUBCOG is not a project. I'm not here to say we'll do it now over the next so many months and be done and just put it on the shelf and never look at it again. It's ongoing. It's not just one thing that one individual can do. It can't just be Keith and Melissa in emergency management. It's multidisciplinary effort, everything from IT to facilities to sheriff, all department heads and elected offices. And it's not just me putting this together and me doing the training and education components. It's all of us as a county. And it has to be actionable. We don't just say that we're going to do this. We need to have education and training and have defined strategic steps we're going to take to accomplish what we set forth to do. And it is a living document. It's just, like I said, it doesn't just go on the shelf. And probably the key component is that education and training element. It does take leadership and commitment. Again, this is from the 2013 edition of NFPA 1600 Standard on Disaster Emergency Management and Business Continuity Programs. Really, this is a guidance document that I've taken some of this information from as well. But the leadership demonstrates commitment to the program. It does also that guidance document does suggest that we have a program committee. I'll get to the planning and steps here shortly, but that program committee is to make sure this is now one-man job being done and that there is an element of buy-in and working together to accomplish this goal that's much needed. That program committee would be appointed by elected officials and department heads. That individual should have direct access to that elected official department head, have some level of authority within that department or office, and be able to work with others in the office or department. Again, I'll come back to that. That's difficult to see up on the screen. It's good on my screen, so I'll just summarize it. The planning element does have several sections. You look at risk assessment, business impact analysis, resource needs assessment, agreements, and objectives for performance. You see some similar messaging through the hazard mitigation processes and other types of planning that you go through. I'm not going to go through all the language down below, but this is the type of information that we would be asking the departments to help compile and put together. There's a great tool that's been put together by FEMA. It's called the Continuity Assistance Tool. It's a fillable PDF that is actually quite extensive in size, but it does help individuals put this information together. The elements of a KUBCOG, these on the screen are the very basic elements, so definitely the KUBCOG as when it's into at the format that's here for adoption and going forth would include these items, essential functions, orders of succession, how delegation of authority is outlined, the continuity facilities, where do we go if one building is destroyed or inoperable, and in that regards to the communications, how do we make sure we have redundancy, what happens there, what kind of records are essential to manage and how do we accomplish that. Our human resources elements, are we able to telecommute if this building's not here standing? What do we do if the roads are blocked, et cetera? Again, as I've said a couple times, a test, training, and exercise program, the devolution of control and direction, and reconstitution. When we're up and going again, how do we go back and go to normal day-to-day operations? The steps I'm here to suggest that you follow. Today is the overview to the Board of Supervisors, and following this, depending on your action today, there's the chair would send an email to the elected officials and department heads with this presentation and then a brief explanation of the process, and then asking that the program committee appointee be sent to me by a certain date. We'll have a program committee meeting in July. Again, I kind of go over this presentation again with them and talk about time frame and expectations, but really get some time on that continuity tool, that CAT tool. August and October, it really goes out of my hands to the program committee members' hands for those individual elected officials and department heads to take that CAT tool and do the data gathering. Through that process, though, I'll be working with Keith to help identify the hazards that we need to address, whether or not we take all the hazards from multi-jurisdictional, multi-hazard mitigation plan, or we narrow that down. Then November to December, over the holiday season, I'm taking what's been put together and putting it together, having a program committee meeting again to really regurgitate that information, go over it one more time, and then board, and that's early next year, and then board discussions early spring next year. I went through it very rapidly. There's a lot to it, and it is not easy. And I think I've said that a couple times, and it's not just me doing this or just the board doing it. It has to be a collective Story County project and program that is ongoing. Are there any questions? And Keith is here, too. Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, so this is one of those items that we've talked about for several years. It is one of those things that you hope you never need, but the reality is if you need to activate a plan like this, there is a complete necessity of governmental operations at that point, because if we have some kind of event that destroys or renders one of our buildings unusable, it's going to impact a lot more than just that.
Right.
So I view this as a necessary step for Story County government. I appreciate Leanne pointing out that this is not just putting together a plan and being done with it. This is a process, an ongoing process. But we've got to start somewhere, and I can't think of a better time to start than right now, because the only other time is later, and why would we start later when we can start right now? Questions or comments?
No, I appreciate the work that you put in this, Leanne. And it's like Rick said, why wait on this if we know that this is something that the county needs to do, and we've known that for a long time. I think this is probably an appropriate time to start.
Ditto.
So it starts. What are we approving today?
The process and the timeline that was submitted.
I don't remember how it was worded on the agenda.
Process and timeline.
Process and timeline.
Yeah, but we don't have a hard and fast timeline laid out here. So basically what we're approving is kicking off this process, and it would be an email from me to those that Leanne mentioned, just letting people know that we are starting this process, and here's step one.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
We have a motion and second. Further discussion. Two.
Aye.
Clinton?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Passes. Leanne, thanks. And you've already sent me verbiage that you want to see?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let's see. We are...
Well...
Discussion and consideration of the Story County Facade Improvement Program.
Well, this was a pilot program that we ran about a year ago, a really tight, short time frame. We did have two entities apply. Collins applied for the painting facade grant element, and then Ziering applied for the building that is now Nigel's. We did not go forth with the painting grant for Collins. They did withdraw their application, but Ziering was funded. We received a lot of positive feedback from the communities that were eligible for this program that they'd like to see it again. So what's before you is kind of a revamped program to somewhat of a degree. I'm going to just go through it quickly on the first page under what was changed from what you saw through the pilot. Under the allowable awards for eligibility, we did add language to clarify what in-kind contributions are. so that the community serves as the applicant knows ahead of time when they're putting the application together what's acceptable and then what is not on the flip side. I do want to point out a change I would propose to make on that first page under eligible applicants. It says the city asks as the applicant should be the city acts as the applicant. Like spell check does not catch when I write the wrong word. So that is a change that with any motion made would need to be recognized. And then on page two, we did also remove the $1,000 painting grant. We didn't really receive a really people jumping up and down saying, please include this, please include this. So we have $10,000 for next fiscal year that if we had the $1,000 painting grant really wouldn't go far if we really wanted to maximize the facade program. Application routing on page two, we did clarify that the city will determine, we removed language that said the city would determine the appropriate amount. We don't really need that in here. The city is going to obviously determine the appropriate amount since they have to match what they're requesting from the community. The applications, if approved today, would go out tomorrow and be accepting applications through August 5th. This will run a fiscal year basis from this point on, and then award the applications received will be on your August 11th agenda, and then award recipients by August 20th. Mm-hmm. One other substantial change was made to the terms of agreement. The prior pilot program did limit if a business owner also happened to wear the other hat that he or she served on a member of city council or mayor capacity. They could not, that building was not eligible. If you look at the smaller communities in Story County, those individuals are wearing many, many hats, and that limited some of those buildings that do necessarily need to take advantage of this funding from coming forward. And I think we have strong leadership in our smaller communities, and we don't really need to worry about the fraud and dishonesty, and that we can self-police that. Also on the terms of agreement, I did notice another item. It does say the work approved for the grant shall be completed by June 1st, 2016. It's June 30th, so the end of fiscal year next year. So with that, I did the program guidelines defined, and again, I have it on the slide too. It has to be June 30th, 2016 is when the work is completed. And the application was just slightly modified. Just to clarify the project information and the contact information, we had some questions on that last year. And with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
It's a good program for our smaller communities.
Yep.
Questions or comments?
No.
All right, so any motion that's made is going to recognize that we're changing the word ask to acts, and we're changing the June 1st to June 30.
Yep. Thank you.
Yep.
I'll make the motion that we approve the facade grant with the noted corrections.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. It passes. Next is discussion consideration of welcome home to Story County Relocation Assistance Program through the Home Base Iowa Initiative. Leanne.
This is a new program that the would be managed by the Board of Supervisors in cooperation with the Ames Economic Development Commission. It's part of one of the many items where Story County and AEDC is offering or would like to offer through the Home Base Iowa, the Story County commitment to that program. Quite simply, it is up to $2,500 for honorably discharged veterans that meet some additional criteria for moving expenses or relocation assistance. It's everything from moving expenses, purchase of appliance, utility deposits, down payment assistance, rent for temporary housing while waiting for that permanent housing. And the eligibility is defined on the screen as well as in the materials that were presented for you today. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Yeah, I just hit the high points here. This is for those individuals who have been honorably discharged within the previous 2 years, who are truly relocating to Iowa, coming to Story County to live in Story County outside of Ames, will work in a Story County business that's part of the home-based Iowa program. And I think I would just add that I think Story County was the second county in Iowa to become part of the Home-Based Iowa Initiative.
Is that second or third?
Third. Okay.
Third. Yeah. A question. The concept, as I look at it, says that they would receive this if they would be an employee of a Story County Home-Based Iowa business. Does that mean they would have to, first of all, become actually employed before they could receive the relocation amount? So, okay. So it's all tied to a business reaching out and employing them. Good. Okay.
And a business that is part of the Iowa program.
Yes, right. Exactly. And we are still recruiting some additional businesses, I understand, and we've had some pretty good reception already from... Yeah, great. That's good. Okay. Good. Well, I would move approval of the Welcome Home Iowa, Welcome Home Story County Relocation Assistance Program as submitted.
Second.
Motion and a second. Further discussion.
Oh, that's a great opportunity. You say give me the money? Oh, well, right now, it's a good question. 2,500. How many do you anticipate this could be? And this is to begin to kick off as of what?
It would be
right now. I'd probably come out of countywide right now. I would think.
It would go into effect July 1st
next fiscal year.
Honestly, we say up to 10 per year. I don't think that we'll be seeing 10 per year. It would be fantastic if we would have one or two per year, and that is, I think, ideally what the goal would be.
Yeah, and conversations with Dan Culhane, it is in the economic development line item, and it will be anything that happens here will be part of that workforce development program and will be a shared expense with the AEDC. And we're just going to see where it goes. You know, there's a maximum dollar amount, and like Leanne says, I don't believe that with the stipulations that we're putting on it that we're going to see anywhere close to this level, but it's nice to have, and it's a nice recruiting tool, potential recruiting tool, for those that might be coming or might have interest in coming. We have a motion and second. Further discussion. Clinton.
Aye.
Toot.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. It passes. Mm-hmm. Next item is consideration of revised Story County Employee Handbook, effective July 1st, 2015. Alyssa Wignall.
Good morning.
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 Okay. So with all of our insurance changes, there were some updates that needed to happen with the handbook. So I went through the complete handbook, minor changes that did not take policy revisions. I'll just go through really quick, and so we can just note those changes on the record. We now only accept online applications through our NeoGov online applicant tracking system. That was changed. We also added when an employee leaves, we want to do an exit interview. Some departments or offices do their own. It's also an HR opportunity to get them their COBRA paperwork or any paperwork that we need to get them when they leave employment with us. Story County adopted an identification badges policy last year, and we have fully implemented that policy. That language has been added to our handbook. There's a section on a notification of arrests and other governmental actions. We would need to know specifically, we do have some positions that require a driver's license or a CDL. It's just typical language in there that we need to get notified in case there's any issue with our employees and their job duties. There's an OSHA regulation out there for restroom breaks and also a section for lactation breaks that we put in there. I've also worked with our facility management director to find a location in each of our buildings as a place if we have anybody that needs to utilize it for lactation purposes. The health insurance information is all updated with what was approved by the Board of Supervisors for the health insurance changes effective July 1st. And then in there, we had made some changes to the life insurance amount and the long-term disability max, so those were updated too. Now, if you look at this, the health insurance information has specific premium and everything in there. That will have to be updated on an annual basis, unless we would have absolutely no increase in any of our premiums.
Okay, questions?
Nope. Good.
I would move approval of the revised Story County Employee Handbook, effective July 1st, 2020.
Second.
Have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Employee Handbook passes. Thanks, Alyssa. We're two departmental reports, and we have the IT report today, because Barb likes to come to us when we've been here all day.
I'll try to make it short and sweet. Barb Steinbeck, Information Technology. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to lead off with something that I know is of interest to all of us here in this room, is the audio upgrade for the boardroom. It is scheduled for June 24th, yay, and it will comprise of just kind of a quick review. We will get rid of the goosenecks for the normal meetings, and we'll have three wireless boundary mics, so you won't have to speak into the mic. We'll still have to use these if we need seven across there, like we do now. But it will also give Shelley a touchscreen panel so that we can build in different room configurations, and that'll dictate how the mics respond. And then also there'll be some upgrades to the circuit board. This will be all we can do with the current system. So in the future, 3 to 5 years down the road, if we need to do something different, we'll have to put in a new system. As far as our networking projects are concerned, we always have a lot of networking to do. And in the past, we have been without a networking person. Kyle Bestie from within the department has accepted the position of network administrator, and I've kept him really busy. And he sometimes looks a little scared, but he's tackled it very well. We have begun work on the Story Medical Fiber Project. I was here earlier to talk about that. They have begun work. We're shooting the fiber last week. It's almost complete, not quite. We are going to have 48 strands of fiber, and we are going to IRU, which basically means lease them back to Story Medical, 4 strands. So that'll leave us a lot of room for future expansions if that's where we decide to go with our redundant loop to our Ames offices. We also have an option of going up past engineering, so we've got some opportunity there. Going south, we'll run into the railroad, which is always a deterrent. I just also wanted to review that Central Iowa Broadband came to us with some significant reductions in the fiber costs. I was here to have you approve the contract. I wanted to point out they didn't have to do this. We were in a 5-year contract, so good for them, and it reduced our costs by, 2/3, so, and increased our bandwidth. So I'm really happy about that and want to continue working with them. They said that for a future expansion plans with the Story Medical Project, if we decided to go with the redundant loop, they would like to assist us with planning in that, because they want to increase, of course, their boundaries as well. So that was encouraging. We're also wrapping up the DOT wireless fiber project. I was also here with you with the DOT to get that approved. The reason we had to do this is a permanent connection between the DOT and the treasurer's office. And the current connection, the T1, is becoming obsolete, and they're phasing it out. So they're doing a 2-part wireless fiber project. It'll be wireless from this building to the Justice Center, and then wired fiber from the Justice Center to the DOT handhole on Highway 30 by the hospital. All of these projects are almost semi-connected. The HSC fiber connection at the HSC building, this will replace the current DSL connection for Internet. That's set to be installed on June 23rd. And I spent some time there last week with CenturyLink trying to find out where actually our 4-inch pipe was, and I just wanted to reassure everyone, no, we are not digging up the parking lot to get into the geothermal system. Actually, we're coming out of the east side of the building by McDonald's, if they were going to do any digging on Story County property, we would have had to enter into an agreement to do that, and they are not. So just rest assured, we're not going to lose anything. But we're still looking at an install date for June 23rd for that. And I'm sure, especially when using ProLaw and doing uploading documents, the county attorney will really notice the difference. Now, we've done some cabling and room setup changes in the EOC admin and the EOC at HSC. What this will do, I don't know if you've been down in that room lately, but all the computers and the phones are centrally located in that room, and there's a huge tripping hazard, so we worked with the electrician to get all that moved centrally. It really looks nice now, and there's central posts where all the connections come down. It's something that will make our safety committee very happy as well. We've done, as many of you have noticed, we've done some upgrade and hardening of the security in our wireless network. We asked communication innovators to come on site to evaluate the setup and help us train the staff on operation and different ways to make that safer for us. We do still have the guest network, which most of you are on, and then we have the wireless internal network, which is the secure network that connects all of our systems. So there is the policy that you have to accept. We're trying to work on having a longer timeout from that. I know every time you leave the building, you have to come back in and accept the security policy on the guest network. We're trying to make that so it's a 24-hour expiration instead of every time you leave the building. I also wanted to mention a little bit about the MAPS-G project with the redundant 911 fiber connection. We did finalize the route. Right now, it's looking at about $170,000 to be split between ISU, the city, and Story County. Doug Houghton is working on a grant from the 911 board, so we're thinking we're holding off on trying to budget this. We're thinking maybe we can get some grant money to help pay for that. I want to talk a little bit about what we did with CLP. In April, we removed all the printers, copiers, shredders from CLP, inventoried it. What we did to make the server room a little more usable for Optime is we mounted a switch rack on the wall and moved our Story County Fiber firewall and our switch to the enclosed cabinet, and then we left the patch panels for Optime to use. And we turned over the VOP, the voice phones, to Optime. We turned over that lease, and they worked with LightEdge to get a connection insight. The connection wasn't quite as easy as they had anticipated, but they're all running up now. Tyler Content Management, I have some good news, finally. It's been a long road. We are getting closer, and Paula has worked very hard on overseeing the data extraction from the AS400 and then the subsequent testing. The test data was installed and evaluated by all the people in the real estate group. They corrected it, and now we're working in the live data. And the only thing left to do is do a formal training session. We're trying to work with Joe Badger from Tyler, who's been very good, trying to get some dates set up for training. But I just wanted to point out, it did take a long time, and all this has gained us is content management for everything real estate related. It does not include, even though the classes were set up, does not include Sheriff's Office and the other departments. I think this needs some reevaluation as to whether we're going to make this an enterprise-wide solution. I just don't feel comfortable or confident in what we've had to go through so far to say, hey, let's throw all of our eggs into this one basket. Tyler version 10. We've had a lot of turnover in the staff in the real estate, like in the assessor's office and the auditor's office, not necessarily in the assessor. They have had a few new people. So in the real estate group meeting last week, we discussed some training, and I've arranged for training. It'll be here in this room tomorrow and the next day. Tyler's coming on site to do training. It seems like there's a lot of confusion on splits. And I know when the auditor enters information for a split, it's in a different fiscal year than what the assessor's year is. So when they do a split, it's a little confusing then on the reports that come out. So that's one of the things, and that's a new person. You know, she wasn't formally trained. So one of the things that we're going to discuss in the training, I had everybody give me a list of topics, and so it's going to be based on that list, 2 days of training. So I'm excited about that. People had questions about the Tyler community and how to submit questions and things about Tyler, and they sent me a cheat sheet that I distributed, and everybody thought that was really helpful as well. Any questions on that? Tyler has been an integral part of Story County for a long time. I wanted to talk a little bit, too, just refresh you on the E911 Zetron Asterix phone implementation for dispatch. I believe this was started in October of 2013, and we're still struggling with outages and hiccups. Found out after the fact, we evaluated three different systems. Of course, we picked the least expensive and found out we were the beta testers, basically, for this rollout. We had a meeting with myself and the sheriff's office and the city and then ISU. Where are we at and where do we want to go with that? We've reached a frustration point, and I know Raycom has too. They aren't getting paid for supporting a system that's not working well. And in order for them to receive payment, we have to enter into what's the 30-day waiting period. And so we've decided to start it. And what this is, if nothing happens within 30 days after you say, you know, today is the day we're starting, then they'll consider the project complete. And every time there is an incident that's related to that system within the 30 days, then it starts over. So we did start it, and we have had incidents, especially lately with people not being able to hear callers. And one thing that makes this very difficult to troubleshoot, we've got a lot of different players that are connected to the system. We've got Windstream, we've got LightEdge, we've got still some Black Box, and then we've got the Raycom support, the Zetron system, we've got the Asterix phone system. So we've got a lot of different moving parts here, and it's been rough, and I don't anticipate that it's going to be over soon. Other items I just want to touch on quickly. We have filled two new positions in the IT department for the computer support analyst. Tim Patterson joined our team in May, and then next week Scott Fay will start. He's an Ames resident. Kyle Bessie, of course, accepted the network administration position. I sent him to some Network Plus training last week, and when I asked him what did he think of it, he just gave me that deer in the headlight look, and he said, there's a lot to learn. But he's doing a good job. As every other department, we're working hard to get all of our claims in by today. One thing that we always struggle with is the maintenance line item, which is one of the biggest items in our budget. But, for example, the Microsoft licensing is a big piece of that, and it's running under a state contract, and we really have difficulty getting some kind of, and as of this morning, we still haven't had an exact amount that we owe. We have a three-year contract that we budget, but then they won't pay off a PO. They only will let us pay off of an invoice. So we're kind of guessing at this point. We hope to have that resolved by the end of the day. Also, another project we're working with the city on is PageGate. And what this does is part of the MAPS G group. We're trying to get the smaller communities involved with notifications and things with our 911 system. And in order to have, a couple of them said, the counties were, or the cities we're working with right now, Story City, Gilbert, Nevada PD, and Huxley. Originally, Huxley said, we want the whole thing. We want, you know, the mobiles in the cars. We want everything. And found out that it was too cost prohibitive. So now we're trying to implement PageGate as a first step to break them into maybe this will work for you. And what it does, it sends text messages. When there's a fire, when there's a call, an emergency, and what the messages will tell them is who's going, where it's at, what's involved. It gives them all the pertinent information without them having a high cost of equipment, hardware, software, licensing, things like that. So I'm hoping this will be what they need, because on the flip side, if they decide they want to go full throttle, like what we do here at the county, there's going to be a lot of extra work, IT-related, and a lot of extra cost for them and support. You know, we always run into who's going to support it with the three agencies and who's going to split out the licensing, who's going to make sure that they're all trained, who's going to do the security. There's a lot of things to do. So I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that PageGate will give them what they need. Also, I wanted to point out, we had the talk earlier about some panic buttons and some security. I do have some money in that was approved for my budget next year for an e-panic kind of demo solution. It's software. It doesn't include any hardware. But also I had Centurion come and do a demo several months ago, and this is a system that Marshalltown uses. So it's something we're looking into. It's something I know is needed. It seems like, unfortunately, it gets pushed aside with other, you know, fires to put out. But it's the direction I think we need to go.
Yeah, well, and I was impressed with the presentation today and the cost of it. I mean, the cost didn't seem prohibitive. So I'd like you guys to dig into it further and just see what it is. And clearly it's something that some other counties have already gone with.
Right. It's very similar to what the Centurion demo showed us. He had it.
Well, I thought I'd seen that.
Yes, you attended that.
Yeah.
It was a different company, but same setup, yes. One thing, I know I talked to some people at CLP, and they used to have the panic buttons that they wore around their necks, and they said that was a lot of trouble. People would reach out and push them just as a joke, or they'd lean over their desk and push it. So that caused a little bit of a problem, but, you know, that's mostly user training. Any questions?
Mm-hmm. Mark, thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
No other reports. That's public forum number two, opportunities for members of the public to comment on items not on today's agenda. Board can't take any action, but we may do so in the future. Anybody wishing to comment? Seeing no one moving to the microphone, liaison assignments and committee meeting updates. Paul?
A couple of weeks ago, I sent in on interviews with Prairie Rivers to hire a watershed coordinator for the Squaw Creek watershed, and individual by the name of Hannah Bates was offered the job and started yesterday.
Outstanding. Cool.
She'll be over here Thursday afternoon to take a peek around. So if you guys are around, I'll introduce you to her. But that's all I've got.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne.
I'll pass.
All righty. Nothing for me. Announcements from the supervisors. Paul?
Pass.
And Wayne?
I'm going to pass.
And I'll pass as well. That takes us to adjournment.
Move adjournment.
Second?
I am second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
See, I listen.